And like I've said about my own farm is sometimes scale is really what creates the most resilience. If you can allow a small farm to stay small, they can mitigate their risk a lot better. They can take care of the land a lot better. So this isn't even just about being organic or being regenerative or doing this other thing, but it's really about letting the small farms have the opportunity to a bigger market.
Welcome to the 400th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. Wait a minute, 400 episodes? My, how time flies when you're having fun. Anyway, I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. For a smaller farming operation seeking to access the kinds of consistent, profitable markets that provide a livable income, grappling with the question of scale can be a major bugaboo. Operations that are just getting off the ground often start out selling at a farmer's market or a roadside stand, or even directly to a few friends, family members, and neighbors. Such relatively low-risk marketing avenues can work well and can serve as stepping stones to further moderate growth, particularly when it comes to vegetable farming. But what if a farm wants to access larger institutional markets like schools or food shelves? Or otherwise get into wholesale systems that provide more cash flow? That can be a quandary. Growing big to access big markets comes with big risks and may make it harder for a farmer to utilize the diverse, regenerative production systems they feel are necessary to be sustainable in the long term. Josh Bryson knows well the challenges of striking such a balance. He and Rama Hoffpower own and operate Turnip Rock Farm and Cosmic Wheel Creamery, a western Wisconsin operation that raises vegetables, garlic for seed, and pork. Josh and Rama's farm also utilizes a small dairy herd to produce fresh and aged cheese. As we learned in episode 399 of Ear to the Ground, the couple is committed to managing a diversity of enterprises as a way to lower their financial risk while building soil and supporting a healthier ecosystem in general. They utilize a variety of marketing options to walk that fine line of remaining small enough to meet their stewardship and quality of life goals, but lucrative enough to support their family. Josh's experience with towing such a tightrope makes him well qualified for the current position he holds with a major food hub in the region. During the past 3 years, he's been the director of grower support programs for the Good Acre, the largest nonprofit food hub in Minnesota. For the past decade, the Good Acre has served as an aggregator of mostly vegetables produced by farmers in Minnesota and western Wisconsin. After that produce is delivered by dozens of individual farmers to the Food Hub's warehouse facilities in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, it's then distributed to various customers, including community-supported agriculture subscribers, a large food bank, schools, and hospitals participating in Veggie RX programs. When it was launched, the Good Acre had $250,000 in gross sales. This year, that number is expected to be $4 million, with 89% of that income going straight back into farmers' hands. That's impressive, but as Josh explained to me during our interview, this food hub attempts to go beyond just serving as a link between producers and buyers. In his position, he's in charge of working with roughly 120 farmers in the region and helping them figure out how to match their production skills, size, income needs, values, and quality of life goals with the markets that the food hub can help them access. The farms range in size from 2 to 200 acres and represent a spectrum of production systems and experience. In short, the Good Acre is aggregating food to supply bigger markets normally not accessible to smaller farmers, while it's attempting to build those farmers up to a point where they are able to meet market demand in a way that fits their operation. It's a complicated dance, to say the least. In this podcast, Josh talks about how he and the other staff at the Food Hub attempt to strike that balance and how such an approach could be a model for making localized food systems an impactful player in the Upper Midwest while supporting an ag economy centered around smaller operations. He started our conversation by providing a description of how a nonprofit food hub can help farmers avoid that get big or get out trap.
Yeah, so the Good Acre is Minnesota's largest nonprofit food hub. I think the best way to describe it is an aggregator, but really this middle supply chain piece that a lot of food systems probably don't have. It's probably more akin in scale to some of our hunger relief systems that we might have. So you think about your food shelves, your food banks, in that kind of process. And really what the Good Acre is trying to do is pull together product from lots of different small farms and achieve bigger markets with those. I really try to explain the Good Acre's role is really that, like, partner and aggregator. So if a farm, if a, say, school program gets money to purchase local product, they have two options. One, they can go to directly to a farm and purchase from them, which Minneapolis Public Schools has a nice program for doing that. But even they see some failure rates in those programs. So say maybe 50%, 60% fail rate sometimes. And so when that happens and that doesn't work out directly with one farmer, the next logical choice is to work with an aggregator. Some of it can be done with like a Russ Davis or a larger aggregator for-profit business. But our role at the Good Acre is really to create that pipeline of beginning farmers, where we have growers that are just getting introduced to wholesale, trying to figure out if it's right part of their business, it's right fit for their farm, and just walking up into this sort of business accelerator model where they can try out a few things for a couple years, and then once they kind of figure out it's the right fit and they've got a specialized product, maybe two or three or four products even, we can start forward contracting with them and making sure they're hitting standards week after week. And what I really like to point out with a Good Acre's role is that we're creating visibility into a supply chain and supply of product that you wouldn't get otherwise. You know, because without this sort of allowing farmers to grow and show what they can do, we don't really know who can grow what. We need more asparagus. Well, who's going to do that?
Right.
You know, until we kind of frame that out, we see that as the biggest, one of the bigger missing links in the whole chain of local food production. It's not so much like who's going to buy the stuff, but it's also who's going to grow the stuff. And the Good Acre is right there in the middle, trying to figure both of those questions out and saying, okay, we're going to tap the markets. We're going to figure out where we can sell the product. But not only that, we're going to turn around and interpret it back to the farmer so they know, okay, we need this product in this form at this time, and the cost is going to be, or the price is going to be this. And once you kind of have all those pieces in place, you can really start to see the local market respond to it, because now you've made it easier for the buyer and you're making it easier for the farmer. Whereas a lot of times, I mean, speaking with my farmer hat on here, is like it's really hard for an individual farmer to go out and find new markets and decide if they want to do them or not, and then try them out and then say a year in, this isn't really for me. And I think the Good Acre's in a good position to sort of let that trial and error happen to a degree, but also press on the gas when it really works. And that's just been like a really cool thing to sit in that sort of front row seat of how are we making all this happen? And you just don't see that level of coordination happening in other places.
Well, you're in a perfect, I would think, a perfect position to kind of look at that and work with that, because you have farmed and you have dealt with that side of it, trying to do the markets and different markets, not just the vegetables, but also doing with the cheese and other products and that thing. So that puts you in a perfect position to kind of look at the challenges that, you know, farmers face, but maybe also what you face in the world of trying to figure out what consumers want, how much they want, that type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, my role there is a director of grower support. So I work with over 120 different farmers in our region with various levels of skill, experience, different phases of their farm life cycle. And it's really interesting to see the patterns that are so similar in many ways across all farmers. You know, it's just like it is almost predictable in a lot of ways. Yeah.
What are some of those patterns?
I mean, just the stuff we talked about, yeah. But like, you know, you'll see a young farmer who is 5 years in and they've got two kids and they're kind of asking these same questions of like, well, how do I keep doing this? You know, what do I do if I go forward? And I think really kind of the nice thing is that I can kind of say, well, this is what the forward path could look like for you. And this is what your contract could look like. Here's the products you could grow. Here's some production tweaks I could give you to help you think about your farm systems. You know, I think a lot of food hubs and larger aggregators actually would say this is more of a get bigger, get out question. I've seen some instances where they would say, An aggregator would say, well, if you're not growing more than 30 acres and you can't do more than half a semi-load, then, you know, we can't really work with you. And I think if you're doing this as a for-profit business, it starts to make sense in that way. But we also see a lot of concern on the other side of that of like, well, who's going to grow once this farmer retires that's growing the half semi-load or 30 acres of whatever the thing is? Who's the next one that's going to do it? Who's coming up behind them? And we don't know the answer to that question. And I think more importantly, if Minnesota and even the upper Midwest is trying to grow their agricultural economy, this question needs to be taken a little more seriously. I mean, there's been a big head turn in this country right now as to look at the upper Midwest as a food producing region. As you see water supplies dwindling in the West and, you know, other climate problems that happen in other parts of the world and even tariffs and other trade problems that we're experiencing currently, you can start to say, like, it's really in our best interest to create an ag economy centered around food and not just commodities. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about this from how do we do this locally, but when we figure out locally, now you can figure out regional. And we figure out regional, maybe there becomes other bigger opportunities, right? And so I think this is kind of the perspective that we're trying to put on this topic is not just about how do you get the small farmer more market and these kinds of things, but how do we get our region to be thinking about coordinating work together? How do we create resiliency in our food supply up here as our own interest, but also as a national interest, as a way to just say we're all kind of working this together, and we need to have a diversity of growers. And like I've said about my own farm, is sometimes scale is really what creates the most resilience. If you can allow a small farm to stay small, they can mitigate their risk a lot better. They can take care of the land a lot better. So this isn't even just about being organic or being regenerative or doing this other thing, but it's really about letting the small farms have the opportunity to a bigger market. And as long as they can interpret it and make these decisions from a business level, from a family level, am I ready for it or not, and do it clear-eyed and understanding, it really makes a lot of sense for them to say yes or no to it. And that's kind of what I really want to offer up here, is that this is an opportunity for farms to step in and say, is this work for me or not? And if it doesn't, it's no harm, no foul. You can do the next thing for you. But without that opportunity, we don't have the vision of who's going to do the farming from here or not. Who's going to grow food here?
Correct me if I'm wrong on this, but this is kind of the way I'm looking at with the Good Acre. It's kind of two components almost, and I know that's way oversimplifying it, but they're serving what the traditional food hub does, which is aggregate food, kind of bring together this food to supply bigger markets and get into markets that all these, it's the like the old saying, farmers doing together what they can't do by themselves kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So there's that traditional part of it, but then also working with the farmers to help them kind of build up to, well, what size do you want to be? What size do you need to be? Maybe what do you need to raise? And kind of doing that, more of that hands-on end of it, which sounds like that's what you're kind of involved with. Is that kind of, I know it's an oversimplification, but that's kind of that two-sided piece that they're doing?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's taking that market analysis that we might be able to make from different conversations here and there and piecing it together, interpreting it, bring it back to the farm and say, hey, we need your beets bunched like this in this case, and this is the price we can offer because this is what the market said. And then we can start having these negotiations and trying to, instead of saying to the farm, like, you got to get up to 3 pallets a week of beets, and that's the only way we're going to work with you, and say, how many can you do? Mm-hmm. And what are the systems on your farm that are holding you back or could improve to help you achieve a cost of production that fits your model? Because it's not going to be the same for everybody. Mm-hmm. And we don't expect it to be. But what we're trying to offer up here is that you are your own business owner. You know your best math of how to do these things. And if there are ways to improve on it, great. We want to help you with that. If the price isn't there for you, then maybe it's not the right fit. But I think coming into it with all of the expectations laid out in transparency is something that the market currently doesn't offer any small farmer. A lot of times, you know, if a farmer wanted to go work with a large aggregator, it's no promises. Bring us what you got and we'll decide if we want to buy it or not. And so it's all the risk on the farm and none of the risk for the market. And what we're trying to do is offer these contracts that say, hey, we'll buy this much of this amount. We'll be as flexible as we can because we work with hunger relief partners. We work with other channels in our market so that, hey, if you show up and your beets don't meet spec, we can find another market for it. And so it's not turning you away, but it's helping you figure it out. And obviously there are limits to some of those things, but we do as much of that as we possibly can because that's our mission, is to build the next generation of farmers.
Yeah, when you were talking about the markets, so what are the main markets for some of the, and I know it also services a lot of food shelves in the area, is that correct? Mm-hmm. But yeah, talk about the markets that you're servicing.
So we work with a large food bank, Second Harvest Heartland. We have about 1,000 members CSA. So we pack boxes for about 1,000 different members. And we work with a number of Veggie RX or Food RX programs with hospitals. Mm-hmm. And they're,
and that's, for people who don't know, that's kind of a cool concept, that whole Veggie RX. Can you just talk about that real briefly?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not the expert on this topic, but for sure it is hospitals kind of looking at a medical need. So say it's diabetes, hypertension, whatever the case might be. And they say, work with a nutritionist and they say, these foods would be great for this medical condition. And we can deliver that box of food to you weekly, monthly, whatever the prescription might call for. Mm-hmm. And the Good Acres role is to both procure and pack those boxes and then deliver them to the hospital. So now the hospital doesn't have the barrier of like, where are we going to get this stuff and how are we going to get it there and who do we know it goes to, and all those logistical details is now solved for them. And all they have to do is make the prescription and apply the logic to it. And we can be a partner in the food system for them on that. So we can find as much of that product as we can locally and deliver it to them ready to go. And that is a service that they probably didn't have in any other way. Like without a food hub or without a sort of middle aggregator doing this, you're never going to have that opportunity. So that hospital is now, would have been left with this decision. Like, do we take on all this logistical pieces? So we really find ourselves being that middle supply partner that actually has a lot more visibility into our local economy and our local food production. And that creates a really great synergy of, you know, now it's not an opportunity just for somebody to pack some boxes and buy stuff from wherever, but now it's an opportunity for our local farmers. And so I think there's a really great, like I said in the beginning, I mean, there's an ease from both ends. You're easy for the buyer, easier for the farmer, and then we kind of act as this sort of quasi co-op in the middle where we're offering these opportunities and trying to pull together both ends of that of the economy.
So yeah, so the food banks and the Veggie RX, and then is there other markets that you guys are kind of reaching into?
Yeah, there's schools. There's a number of other kind of smaller institutions that end up working with us. Our beginning farmer program is the LEAF program, which is started out as a pandemic response program, but has now turned in more of this beginning wholesale beginnings kind of operation, where all of that produce just goes straight as a donation to the food shelves in our region.
So talk a little bit about your, specifically what you're doing. You said you're working with about 120 farmers. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a lot.
Yeah. I have two other people on my team.
Okay, so good. Good to hear. But yeah, talk about what's your typical day? I know there's no typical day, but yeah, kind of what you're doing with that and how your role, you're serving. And yeah, what I know it's all vegetable farmers, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but what the range, it must be a range in size and kind of where, obviously how many years they've been doing it, all that mm-hmm. type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, maybe I could just frame up kind of like our annual process and okay. instead of like the daily thing, because it's kind of hard to name that. But so we start out, if we start at the beginning in the winter, we're looking at our supply demand forecasts for what we can sell, what did we do last year. And from there, we build contracts. We share those contracts with the farmers. We say, here are the crops we want to buy from you. Here's the prices, here are the things. And we're just now wrapping up our orientation season, where we build out slide decks and talk about all the details of what we require to deliver to the Good Acre. And we train, you know, do these orientations and trainings around both food safety and sort of the orientation around selling. And then once the orientations are over and we feel like all the farmers have the information they need to carry forward, we'll start doing farm visits. So last year we visited 85 farms, me and my grower support team. I wasn't on every single one of them, but we went out to 85 different farms. And some of that work there is number one, we're just verifying that they're growing and what they said they're going to grow, just as a surface level check on the fields. But then we really start to get into the personal relationship pieces. So like, tell me about how you're, you know, what can be improved here? What does your wash and pack setup look like? How do you feel like, what are your barriers? What are your labor sources? How do you want to progress in your business? What are the things you want to do? And, you know, Brian, you're on my farm right now, and I feel like we've built a great rapport, and, like, you know, we've got a relationship. But so you know what happens when you're first face-to-face, when you're on somebody's place, and that you see the work they're doing, and you develop an appreciation and relationship with it. So it's a really great time to sort of connect with them on a personal level and figure out what their goals are and help them achieve, not only from this level of like, well, I'm the buyer and you got to do what I say to do, but probably from this perspective of like, I'm a farmer too, and I know other farmers. And if you got questions, I can help you piece it together. This isn't just me telling you what to do. I'm not an authority figure. Right. I want to be a partner. I want to be someone that can help you and a resource. And so it's really nice to be able to walk into a farm without sort of like an expectation, because we've already talked about the business stuff. Mm-hmm. We're here just to talk about the production stuff and talk about food safety stuff and what are the things that you need to make sure you can keep going. So we go through that period of the season, and then by the end of the season, we start doing post-season reviews. How did all your deliveries come in? What were things you could improve on? We try to do this on the dock and while deliveries are happening, but farming season is busy and it's not always the best time to try and have long conversations. So we put that towards the end of the season, and then it all starts over again. We say, okay, this was the feedback we got from the product you brought in. Maybe there are things we take off your contract, maybe things we go up on your contract, and by 2 or 3 years in, we kind of got a really good idea of what that farm is capable of and where their capacity is, and we got a sense of, say, yeah, they want to grow up or they want to kind of stay put. And so we try to translate all that into the market again. So every season that goes by, obviously every farm is in a different part of their life, right? So some farms might lose a family member. Some farms might have to leave the country. Some farms might decide, I don't want to farm anymore. And so we take all that into account, and then we just try to recreate the contracts again. And so it's cyclical in that way, but it's a lot different than a system where you say, just bring me what you got and we'll figure it out. Yeah. And I think that this is a way, like this sort of like translation of market, forward contracting becomes a way that we can really grasp, how do we grow more farmers? How do we grow more supply of certain products? Otherwise, you're sort of grasping at straws and trying to reiterate on things. And then if we think about overlaying the life cycle of a farm in that situation, it's like by year five, maybe you've kind of hit a lick and you figured out, well, we can do this and this is working right now. And then that farm decides, hey, I've got two kids, I don't want to do this anymore. And so now you got to start over with another farm. And what we're trying to solve is that piece of like, how do you keep the ball rolling without the whole thing coming to a stop and everyone having to refigure everything out again? Mm-hmm. And I think local food has remained, in a lot of ways, in the last 20 years for me, I mean, has remained a small and cute and like, oh, farmer's market kind of margins thing. It's a niche crop, as my grandfather would tell me. Again, the niche crop. Okay, I want us to kind of move from this niche thing to big, to more impactful, so that, you know, if the 50-acre dairy decides they want to put in 5 acres of winter squash, where could they sell it? You know, how could these family-sized farms that we all know are around here and looking for economic opportunities, how can they make transitions? How can the beginning farmer who's renting 10 acres make a go of it?
You're trying to grow, figure out how to grow the market and grow and what can be grown for the market, but how to grow the farmers too. It's that two-sided thing, because often it's just one or the other, and they don't, it's two ships passing in the night, but you're trying to dovetail those two things.
Yeah, and it's only going to happen in this middle part, right? It's not going to happen at the big entities, and it's not going to happen at really, really small entities, like your farmers markets, which are super important, but that's not their role, right? So it really is like creating this middle piece of our food system where the logistics can be handled, the marketing can be handled, their interpretation of that market can be handled. And I think the sort of like very distinct and different piece is that we're approaching the supply with a lot more intentionality of saying we want to grow the small businesses into businesses that are sustainable, not to grow them into big businesses necessarily, but into sizes that that family can handle, that they want to do it and it makes sense for them. Because we know that first 5 years of farming is critical. And if they can't make enough markets to make ends meet, they probably won't make it past. And so we have a lot of success stories in our network of farmers who have started out at farmers markets, got into wholesale, they've bought their own land, and they're running pretty successful businesses with multiple market channels. So it's not just the Good Acre they're relying on, but we become another tool in their tool belt, another resource for them to lean on, and it becomes a great opportunity for them to know that they can go another season, right? Because we're not just saying, yeah, bring us what you get next time and we'll figure it out. We're saying, no, here's our contract. Here's what we want to commit to. And it's those commitments that you don't get from a farmer's market. You rarely get them from a CSA. I mean, your customers are pretty loyal most of the time, and they come back and they pay at the head of the season, all great things. But there's hardly anyone else out there that's saying, you know, we're going to guarantee to buy this from you.
What kind of geographic area are you covering?
It's pretty much the entire state of Minnesota and even into western Wisconsin here, a number of farmers. So we have farmers, you know, all the way up in the Red River Valley, all the way down into Rochester.
And the size must vary quite a bit.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, we've got some farms that are 200 acres, mm-hmm. and we got farms that are two. You know, it's all over the board and all different kinds of products and all different sort of production styles, too.
How long has the Good Acre been going, do you know?
They just turned 10 years old.
10 years old. So I think that's an important to note. So I often get calls from folks to say, I love the concept of the food hub. The concept is awesome. It's a way to aggregate food and feed that local market, make something bigger from many smaller pieces. But often I get a call from somebody say, hey, you should do an article or do a podcast on this food hub. By the time I get around making a call, the food hub is no longer in business. It seems like maybe the mistake that's made, and I'm not an expert on this and I'll get pilloried for this, but just thinking, the mistake that's often been made is, well, we'll start out as a nonprofit, kind of we'll rely on volunteer services to get this going. Then it will, as a for-profit venture, take off on its own. It doesn't. That seems to be where it hits the barrier and doesn't get beyond that. The Good Acre has committed to being a nonprofit, serving people who are for-profit entities, the farmers trying to make money. It seems like maybe that model, for it to be around 10 years and seems to be doing well, that seems to be maybe the way to go, at least in this case.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the go-to argument that I make here is that the for-profit thing already exists. We have large aggregators, we have large distributors that buy product from all over the region, from the country, from the world. And what we don't want to do is recreate the wheel. Like, we're not trying to create the same thing over again. So we start to have to really think about the services that we're providing, what are the problems that we're really trying to solve. And I think, you know, we're trying to frame that up here and saying that we're trying to solve a farming question of like, where is our food going to come from and who's going to grow it and how is it going to get to us? But we're also trying to solve this market question. How do you get local places to prioritize their sale, you know, their buying power into local? I think one of the important pieces of this is like local foods should be looked at as some of like our backup generator. Mm-hmm. And we saw some fragile supply chains during COVID that made some of our grocery store shelves bare. And we all started to have a moment of saying like, wait a second, where should I be getting my food from? Because if this goes away, then where are my options? And the shorter your supply chain is, the stronger it'll be, right? We saw a lot of places kind of make that pivot during the COVID years. Although I wasn't there, but the stories I hear during that time was once a restaurant couldn't get certain products or schools couldn't get hold of certain products, it was pretty easy for them to get a hold of the Good Acre or any other local farmer and say, hey, I need this stuff. And these relationships become really important, right? It's resiliency from a food system level. And I think it doesn't happen by flipping on a switch, right? You know, farming takes time. And I think we won't see the impacts, the negative impacts of things we're seeing right now until much later next year, even because of the timing and the way things work on a farm. And so I think it's the same way. We have to forward plan these things. If we want a backup generator that's there to turn on when we need it, we don't get to just decide to turn it on one day. You have to keep it maintained and you have to keep it operating and practicing, because if you don't, you may not be there when you need it.
Do you have a very rough idea of, in a year's time, to give a sense of the volume, either kind of the amount of money that's being handled, or the volume of vegetables that are being handled, or the money that's changing hands, or what kind of an impact we're having that way?
Yeah, so when the Good Acre first started, they started out at $250,000 in gross sales. And this past year, we approached $3.5 million. And we're on track this year to do $4 million in sales. And the goals now is to, by 2030, we want to be at $6 million. And soon after that, we want to get to 10. So our goals right now are to get to 10 million in gross sales. Produce-wise, I would say probably 60 to 70% of that number is always going to be produce. Mm-hmm. But there's obviously other grocery items that we're moving as well. And when we talk about margins, our profit margin is 11% on those produce. So 89% of all those produce dollars is going back into the farmer's hands. And that, to me, is a huge distinct difference from other operations that are doing that. So obviously, we try to work with blended pricing models so that if one customer pays a lower price and another one pays a higher price, say our CSA customers, we kind of account for one price, and then, you know, schools account for another price. We blend those prices together so that we're paying the farmer what is fair and agreed upon price that's set for the season. So it's not fluctuating week to week, which is pretty common in the normal vegetable market, but it's a set price for the year and it's an agreed upon margin on those crops, or not margin, but agreed upon price and volume on that.
So you've been doing this for 3 years yourself. So you're at that point probably where you're starting to maybe figure out what are the biggest challenges. You said there's some patterns sometimes that you see, but yeah, what are some of the biggest challenges for, I guess, for farmers who are trying to access markets, but also for your program, for the Green Acre, what they're trying to do here? What are some things that you're, every year you're like, oh, I wish we could figure out a way to kind of get around this, or we're trying to tweak some things to kind of get around this challenge accomplish what we want to accomplish?
Yeah, I think a lot of some of the things that we're grappling with, like as an organization, are really about just sort of the right level of technology and the right type of expertise we have in the room. And I think this is really kind of a cool thing that Good Acre is doing right now, is where we're adapting some warehouse management systems, CRM tools, or customer relationship management tools. I'm really hopeful that we get into some learning management systems for our farmers so that we can get more clear educational materials to the people that need them. But it's really that sort of like tech piece that becomes something we're grappling with right now. And I think we've made some really good progress on it in the recent years. But it's such a, what we see over and over, and when we solve for these problems, is that it creates such a great impact for the ease of operations. So, you know, we'll have inventory that we know even before it hits our warehouse, we'll know that it's coming, and we can kind of start to predict where it's going to go, where it lives in the warehouse. And that's a level of sophistication that much larger entities have. So I think it's been a journey for a small entity to kind of start grow into these tech systems that are already out there, because they are so geared for such a larger business, and sometimes even geared for non-perishable items, right? So we have these multiple layers of, we're working with, proportionately for the amount of sales we do, work with a lot of vendors, And so we have a lot of complexity on our supply of, like, when is that product coming in at what time and what's the quality, what variable thing is going to happen week to week. But we're also kind of overlaying that with, like, okay, once it's in-house in our docks, where does it live in the warehouse? What truck is it going out on? What pallet do you have to take apart and re-aggregate? So, you know, we're putting in pallet wrappers. We're putting in shelving to kind of solve some of these logistical things. I think we're at a point, I think the biggest thing is we're outgrowing our warehouse. You know, we're at 15,000 square feet, and we've grown from 250,000 to 3.5 million and going up. And our square footage does not get bigger. And so, yeah, even our docks are kind of hard for a full-size semi to back up to those doors. So, and even the doors that we have, I mean, you know, 100 farmers a week, you know, we might have 30 or 40 farmers in a sort of four-hour window dropping off product. So you really got to move the drop-off line pretty fast, which just creates levels of complexity of, like, how do you check the product? How do you have the conversation? How do you keep things moving, but check all the boxes that you need to check when the delivery is happening. So I think that, like, looking out into the future, I see that, like, space limitation and sort of developing our technology and having the experience and professional staff on hand to be able to, like, grapple with that change and the growth is really going to be the thing that we're hoping to solve for. On the grower support side, I mean, like I said, it's we're talking with a lot of farmers. There's a lot of complex information that we're trying to interpret for people and, like, put it in a format that's digestible and understandable. And so I kind of look at the work that we do as adult learning. It's sort of learning management systems, but not a fire hose of information, but drips of information. You want drip irrigation on the information. So it's really, in my mind, it's really solving for getting the right piece of information in the farmer's hand at the right time. You know, we all know that the middle of August is not the right time to solve, you know, what tomato variety you're going to grow. But how do you see that on a farm visit and go, oh, you chose this variety, I think this other one would have been better for you. And so now we get into this sort of, like, customer relationship management. So how do we make that note that, like, hey, this farm chose this variety, let's make this other recommendation later. How do we say this farm could really benefit for some irrigation because they're on sandier soil? It's all the complexities as we develop that sort of personal relationship, but we really want to have this sort of, like, deeper understanding and knowledge of their farm. So it's not just a revisit the same thing over and over again, but we have a progressive kind of relationship. Say, oh, I know your farm has these items, you're looking to do this. And so really our goal is to kind of name those goals that the farm has and help them achieve them without trying to revisit the whole thing over and over again, but try to push them further without everybody resetting.
It just struck me, this must be a tremendous service for emerging farmers, farmers of color, immigrant farmers who have maybe traditionally been kind of left out of certain programs or certain initiatives of that kind of. This must be really a benefit for those folks.
Yeah, over 85% of our farmers are emerging farmers or farmers of color. I think the thing that's been missing from the programs is really this market opportunity, the chance to try. And of course, it's pretty easy to say, yeah, I just want to sell more stuff. But, you know, it's pretty quick and easy to kind of look around and say, hey, this farm really is trying. Like, they really want to engage with this work. Mm-hmm. And give them those opportunities and make sure you're kind of, like, leading them down a path of success here. Yeah, it's just really rewarding for me to kind of see that happening in real time. You know, I mentioned we have farmers that, you know, started out with just one or two farmers markets on some rented land who now own land, living on that land, and now stewarding probably 15, 20-acre vegetable farms. We have really clear and distinct numbers that the work that we're doing actually translates into viable businesses. It's the same thing that brings me all the way back to, like, when I first moved up here, I was working for incubators, Big River Farms, incubator farm in Marine on St. Croix. And it was the same thing happening there. It's given the opportunity, given the chance to grow on the land, given the chance to develop a market, and give them the right tools, and they'll show up and make a business. And I just think there's such huge potential here. Doing the back of the napkin math, we've got over 1,000 acres of vegetable production just in our network of current production. And not all of that's coming to the Good Acre, obviously, but the sort of economics of that, if you think every acre of vegetables is worth $16,000, $20,000 minimum, grown well, and obviously a lot of other factors, but that's real impact. And that's real dollars going to real farmers.
That's real farming.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it is dismissed a lot, especially in the Midwest. Oh, that's just a glorified garden or whatever. But that's, when you put it that way, that's a huge impact.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's pretty easy for a commodity farm to, you know, when you look at, you think about it in the same way, right? A corn acre of corn is $200, but a 5-acre vegetable farm can actually be a full-time job and a living.
Oh, yeah.
And should be, because it's enough work for sure.
I know personally
how much it is. Yeah.
So do you see something like this as something that could be replicated, or have you seen it? Do you know of any other models like this, or is this a little bit of a lightning is striking in one place and things kind of came together? We had the farmers that were, I mean, we kind of have that community, and I don't know, that's maybe an unfair question, but for you, because you're kind of working, got your nose to the grindstone on this particular initiative, but you've been around long enough to, as a farmer too, and struggled with marketing. But do you think this is something that could be replicated?
Yes, to a degree. I do think it can be. I think one of the things that, maybe just get this out of the way first, is like the unique thing about Minnesota is that we have a lot of specialty crop growers in this state. The Hmong families, Latino families, all the new immigrant families that have come here and just said, I want to farm, mm-hmm. as just like a cultural thing that I want to do. I want to teach my kids that. I want to have my access to that food in that way. And they carved out their own markets and they go to their farmers markets. I mean, that is a very unique and special advantage that we have here in this state. And so it's not to look past as like anyone could do that, because I think it's like a really special thing to have. But with that said, I mean, we talk to people all the way in North Dakota doing similar initiatives, people in Wisconsin doing similar initiatives, people in Illinois, Iowa. There's similar projects like this happening. I think some of the like special sauce is that we are figuring out ways to include the small growers and how to introduce them to the wholesale buying process, mm-hmm. and how to give them that opportunity to make that choice if it's the right fit for their business or not. So I think some cases, food hubs or other aggregators will kind of look at it and say, we just don't really have the bandwidth to handle that many vendors for that few. And so I think there's something about this where you have to look at the long game and you have to say it's worth building up small farmers and it's worth showing the opportunity to probably way more people than you think is necessary, mm-hmm. And give them that opportunity. But also at the same time, put guardrails up and make sure that you have the right systems in place to make sure that they're a right fit for the program. And don't just say this is everybody in the pool all the time, but say we have a pretty distinct goal that we're shooting for. If you can't put it in the right box and you don't meet the standards, maybe this isn't the right fit for you. And we have to think about other things to do. Think about other markets. So it's kind of a both and. I think any region can do that. But I think we have done this in Minnesota a lot more intentionally over the past 20 years. Like I said, I was involved with Big River Farms as an incubator. I mean, yeah. That was 25 years ago, and that's still going. And how many businesses have spun out of the incubators, and how many of incubators are happening in Iowa? How many are happening? There's some of those things happening, but we've been doing it for a while, and I think that's unique. But I don't think that it's beyond the reach of anybody in any other part of the upper Midwest. And I can't really speak too much to like what's happening in the coasts and other, you know, the places. But when you think about the totality of what's going on in the upper Midwest, I think it's replicable. And I think our goal at the Good Acre is to really try to take what we've learned and help other people kind of apply that to their region as well, so that they don't have the same kind of learning curves. But there's just really some really distinct milestones that we've gone through that we can point to and say that's what helped us grow and that's what helped us get to where we are right now.
For more information on the Good Acre Food Hub and LSP's community-based food systems work, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode number 400 at landstewardshipproject.org. On that page, you'll also find a link to my previous interview with Josh Bryson. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendell, Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. And as we mark the 400th episode of LSP's Ear to the Ground podcast, I'd like to send a special shout out to all the farmers, scientists, natural resource professionals, food businesses, organizers, and other folks who have put up with my pesky questions over the past two decades. Many of those interviews have been conducted after an exhausting field day or meeting, when the last thing on my subject's mind was answering a bunch of questions. Perhaps the most memorable setting was an interview I did with a dairy farmer while he held his sleeping infant daughter and a big barn rat scrabbled around in the background. Anyway, here's to many more podcasting adventures. Thanks for listening.